Welcome to the Voice Over Work podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Newton Media Group, a family of creative services. On the podcast today, we take a little deeper look into a book introduced in a previous podcast with a chapter-by-chapter look at The Art of Thinking Critically. Ask great questions, spot illogical reasoning, and make sharp arguments. The Critical Thinker, Book 5, written by Albert Rutherford, narrated by Russell Newton. Introduction. Any parent can tell you that somewhere around 18 to 30 months of age, as adorable and innocent as your sweet child may seem, he or she becomes a force unto themselves. This is what parents refer to as the terrible twos, and this is when children begin to express their own likes and dislikes and wonder how the world works. One of a toddler's favorite games is the Why game. If you aren't familiar with this game, it goes something like this. Parent: Sarah, it's time to pick up the toys. Help Daddy pick up your books. Sarah: Why? Parent: Because we want to make sure we leave the room neat and tidy. Sarah: Why? Parent: Because it's time for bed, and it's important we clean up after ourselves. Sarah: Why? Parent: When I come check on you in the middle of the night, I don't want to trip on any toys. Why? Now, this pantomime is somewhat of an exaggeration, but it shows an inherent skill needed for critical thinking: asking questions. We need to be able to ask questions, sometimes very difficult ones, that cause the personal evaluation of values, and we need to know where to look and how to determine sets of facts over strictly intuitive thought or emotion. Emotional or thoughtless responses can have a lot of unintended consequences, though those can be positive or negative. In many areas of the United States, people live in areas that are prone to damage from hurricanes or the floodplain of a river. As a consequence, many of these homeowners purchase both home insurance and flood insurance, and they sometimes will also purchase a special hurricane insurance policy if they live in a location where hurricanes are prevalent. My uncle and his... When my children were in high school, the internet was still in its infancy and hadn't reached its full potential as a tool for reviewing research or a resource to understand other people's point of view on specific topics. Back then, we commonly received CDs in the mail from whatever ISP was hot at the moment, boasting their free email account and cheap dial-up. At that time, most people used the internet to play games or used software packages to make their work of school assignments easier. Today, most of us just whip out our cell phones and Google the answer to any question that comes our way. The biggest challenge we face is determining the good sources from bad ones. What was the War of the Roses? Oh, it was a series of civil wars in England over who had more of a claim to the throne. When my children wrote research papers, they had to visit the school library and make use of the available reference material there, such as an encyclopedia. I cannot recall the last time I used an encyclopedia as any type of resource. This process is so outdated. I also had to raid the change jar on my dresser so the kids would be able to make copies and ensure they got all the requisite pieces needed to cite their work properly. Some of the reference books weren't permitted to be checked out. If the school library didn't have what was needed, I often found myself sitting in the local library or even the college library on the weekend as more. In hindsight, pre-internet learning seems painstakingly slow and not at all interactive in comparison to the learning we see in classrooms today. Teachers have a very difficult job. I've been in a K-12 classroom, and I've worked in higher education, both as an administrator and instructor. I would much rather be on a college campus any day of the week. One challenge teachers face is keeping the delivery of information. Chapter 2, Awaken Curiosity. As we've discussed at the opening of this book, childlike curiosity is similar to the burgeoning curiosity that drives critical thinking. Children experience each new sensation or exposure to a topic in a way that's difficult for us to understand as adults, because in most circumstances, a large portion of our daily routines are just that, routine. We've ordered the same vanilla latte at Starbucks 1,000 times.
It might be a different Starbucks, but the drink is the same. Children want to know where you went when you hide your face in your hands and then pop back up a few seconds later saying, "Peekaboo, I see you." Every new food is a new flavor and new consistency, and it takes time for children to develop their tastes and know what they do and do not like. Some things will become abundantly clear very quickly. When my son was 6 months old, my wife attempted to feed him avocado she had mashed up, thinking he'd love the superfood she had eaten frequently throughout her pregnancy. As soon as she got the first spoonful into his mouth, it was clear to me, from the facial expression and the sheer repugnancy displayed from his infant body trying to expel the avocado from his mouth, my son was sure his mom was trying to poison him. On the other hand, I know for a fact we fed that kid a huge variety of foods as a young child, but getting him to eat fruits and veggies as a child and teen was like pulling teeth. Kids are born with an insatiable hunger for knowledge, but as we grow, that curiosity can be stamped out. Sometimes this is because asking questions is simply seen as almost sacrilegious or unacceptable. When Galileo put forth his theory of heliocentrism, he was held for suspicion of heresy and put under house arrest until his death at 8. Chapter 3. Herd Mentality and Biases. In 1974, members of the People's Temple, led by Jim Jones, moved to Guyana to start an agricultural commune. One of the tactics Jones used to maintain control and obedience over his followers at Jonestown would be to have them drink Kool-Aid he told them had been laced with poison on occasions called white nights. During these times, Jones would tell his members genocide had started outside the doors of the temple, and he would instruct them to drink a cyanide-laced drink to save themselves. However, this would all turn out to be completely untrue, and the drink was perfectly potable. Later, in 1978, the White Knights turned out to be practice runs for the mass suicide conducted at Jonestown. 918 people died as a result of drinking poisoned Flavor-Aid. It would have only taken minutes for the first effects of the cyanide that had been added to the drink to become apparent in the people who had taken the first few cups, and cyanide poisoning is not a gentle death. However, Jim Jones' authority and hold on temple members was so strong, they obeyed his authority to their deaths. While the massacre at Jonestown is an extreme example of herd mentality, it is certainly not the first such example, and sadly, it has not been the last. Herd mentality. Herd mentality is defined as individuals can be influenced by their peers or a group to adopt specific behaviors based primarily on an emotional response rather than reasonable thought process. Herd mentality is often referred to as mob mentality or gang mentality as well, because people behave differently in the group than they would otherwise individually. Chapter 4. Asking the Right Questions. You have likely picked up on the fact that I enjoy reading and watching documentaries about true crime and unsolved mysteries. One of the cases that I've been drawn to over the years has been essentially solved, though for some people, the resolution is considered unacceptable. While I love these mysteries, I also hate the inevitable not knowing that accompanies a mystery. On January 28, 2013, Elisa Lam checked into the Cecil Hotel in downtown Los Angeles, California. The Cecil is quite an infamous hotel and was previously home to serial killers Richard Ramirez, also known as the Night Stalker, and Jack Unterberger. The Cecil is located in the Skid Row area of downtown Los Angeles and has had a long-time reputation for violence and suicide. Elisa was supposed to check out of the Cecil on January 31st, 2013, but other than a video of Elisa behaving oddly and no explanation as to why, she was never seen alive again. Approximately 3 weeks later, patrons at the Cecil Hotel began to complain about low water pressure, a foul taste in the hotel's water, and also a discolored and unpleasant smell to the water. The Cecil collected rainwater in four huge cisterns on its roof. When the maintenance manager went to check the cisterns, He opened one to discover Elisa Lam's body floating inside. This case has been a big mystery for many people because there are so many unanswered questions and strange incidences, but also because it also clearly seemed Elisa had been a victim of foul play from the start. This first goes back to an elevator surveillance video collected at the Cecil Hotel. Elisa appears to be hiding from someone, but also gesticulating wildly. Chapter 5, Critical Reasoning. Have you ever heard the expression, "You don't know what you don't know"? The meaning behind the expression is you're not even aware there's knowledge about a particular topic you're missing, so you're simply oblivious to its very existence. I purchased my first home in my early 30s. It was brand new, and I was pleased as punch to be a homeowner. That is, until I began to realize all the maintenance and upkeep that's required. Mowing the lawn, weeding the garden, trimming the trees, it was never ending. Then one afternoon I came home from work, and my front and side yard were flooded. I walked the yard, and I couldn't find a hose that had been left on, a busted sprinkler head, nothing to indicate where all this water was coming from. Exasperated, I gave up and called my father. He asked me if I'd checked my water meter. My what? This was definitely a case of you don't know what you don't know. I had no idea I had a water meter, let alone where the meter was. Garage? No. Side of the house with the other meters? Nope. Back of the house? Nada. I couldn't find it. I called my father back. This time, he asked if I'd looked in the ground. In the where? He proceeded to explain the meter was likely close to our property line, buried in the ground with a plastic hatch covering, and it would likely be close to a street the city had access to, as I at least knew I was connected to the city water supply. 10 minutes later, I uncovered the hatch and a broken water meter drowning in the murky depths of its concrete home. The meter itself was completely submerged, with about a foot of water. Luckily, the city came out to replace the meter, and my grass got a good watering for free. But in my panic, I didn't really stop to clearly think about where all this water had mysteriously come from, other than the most obvious of sources. Chapter 6, Relevance Assessment and Inference. One of the more embarrassing moments of my life occurred when I was in high school. I'm sure we all have some iteration of the statement I just made. Thankfully for me, this is not going to turn into a tale similar to the several installments of the American Pie franchise, but I wasn't any less embarrassed. In this instance, my advanced placement United States history class had been divided into two teams for a debate. I forget the topic, but distinctly recall my argument that the opposing side was mistaken in their application of habeas corpus. I argued the opposing side did not understand the legal concept because it meant to present the body in a murder trial, and you couldn't be successful in that kind of trial without proof the person was deceased. I think I was really smug about it, too. Oh, the teenage trauma, as my classmates disintegrated into laughter, and the teacher stepped in to correct me as my cheeks turned scarlet. While habeas corpus may literally translate from Latin to read, to present the body, its meaning in law doesn't have anything to do with murder victims and the ability to win a trial. Can you imagine prosecutors across the country wheeling the deceased into a courtroom and pointing to a casket in the corner saying, "See, it's really him"? That's just ludicrous. What was my 15-year-old self thinking? Habeas corpus is legally any of several writs requiring that a person be brought before the court. To be clear, these people are alive.
More than just being humiliating, this is a clear example of not being aware of the relevant information. I didn't prepare properly for the debate, hastily read through the definition to habeas corpus, misinterpreted, and made a glaring error. Imagine this wasn't high school, but Chapter 7, The Socratic Method. The Socratic Method refers to the practice of intellectual inquiry developed by Socrates and recorded in the accounts of his debates. Socrates used this method to deconstruct his opponent's arguments to find the inevitable gaps in logic, contradictions, or lack of proof. Socrates would ask his opponents a series of questions about their beliefs, eventually leading them to declare the flaws in their arguments. You can think of this as the question everything mindset, which encourages people to question authority and preconceived beliefs or dogma. Socrates' goal was to reveal that people in power are not necessarily always right, that people should think for themselves and consider different arguments instead of blindly following their leaders. This process of thinking ideally involved finding hard evidence, determining if there were any flaws in logic, and predicting the implications of actions and words. The Socratic method is the most frequently used and famous critical thinking strategy because it provides a simple format for analyzing any argument. Critical thinking in general has the same ends as the Socratic method, analyzing beliefs and explanations, determining what makes an argument reasonable or not, and separating emotions from the intellectual merit of an argument or belief. There's no limitation to the types of questions one can ask in the Socratic method, but some questions are more helpful to the critical thinking process than others. Questions should be focused, respectful, intellectual, and critical, tuned to analyze processes, ask for more data, brainstorm interpretations, and counter assumptions. A Socratic questioner should be comfortable asking questions that keep the conversation moving, moderate the discussion. Chapter 8, John Stuart Mill. The only way in which a human being can make some approach to knowing the whole of a subject is by hearing what can be said about it by persons of every variety of opinion and studying all modes in which it can be looked at by every character of mind. John Stuart Mill, On Liberty, 1859. John Stuart Mill was born in 1806 in Great Britain, died in 1873, and was one of the greatest critical thinkers of his time. He worked for the government as a civil servant and political economist. He's considered one of the forefathers of liberalism, and his philosophy focused on individual freedom above state and society. He was an early suffragist and politician in Parliament, and many of his ideas were far ahead of his time. Mill's genius in original thinking isn't a coincidence. His education came from his father, James Mill, and the famous philosopher Jeremy Bentham. Mill was socially isolated from other children while growing up. Most of his energy was focused on learning. His father was utilitarian and hoped to shape Mill into the next great utilitarian thinker, taking up Bentham's legacy and further developing the school of thought. As a result of his own childhood, Mill was intensely interested in education. He wrote extensively about the teaching methods his father used. While often cruel by today's standards, they do provide interesting ideas for how to train a mind to become a great critical thinker. Mill's father's method was based on disciplining and developing the mind. He was intensely attentive to Mill as he was his only student. However, James Mill did understand what made a mind disciplined and was able to train young Mill to think critically using... Chapter 9, Paul Elder's Contribution. Dr. Richard Paul, the Director of Research and Professional Development at the Center for Critical Thinking and former chair of the National Council for Excellence in Critical Thinking, wrote numerous books and articles on the subject that garnered him world recognition. He worked with his wife, Dr. Linda Elder, an educational psychologist, author, teacher, and presenter, who's also recognized as an authority on critical thinking. She's the president of the Foundation for Critical Thinking, as well as the executive director of the Center for Critical Thinking. The Paul Elder framework is composed by three parts: the elements of thought, reasoning, the intellectual standards that should be applied to the elements of reasoning, the intellectual traits associated with a cultivated critical thinker that result from the consistent and disciplined application of the intellectual standards to the elements of thought. According to Paul and Elder, to upgrade thinking, one needs to be able to identify the parts of their thinking and then to assess their use of these parts of thinking. The eight elements of thought. Reasoning. 1. Purpose. All reasoning has a purpose. Behind any reasoning, there is always a purpose which must be considered.
The purpose is the goal you're trying to achieve with the reasoning. You might want to solve a problem, answer a question, or increase understanding, but you must know where you're going or you'll never know when you get there. Be sure to check in with your purpose frequently to ensure that you're still conveying the desired message. 2. Question. All reasoning is an attempt to figure something out, to settle some question, to solve some problem. 10. Implemented critical thinking in your daily life. Now that we've explored both the major components of critical thinking and explored it through the ages, let's put all this information together to see where we can practice this skill in our everyday lives. Critical thinking is not just a technique you want to use when making big decisions, but an ability you can develop and perfect over time with practice. If you begin practicing critical thinking methods daily, when you need to make a life-altering decision, it will feel like second nature. Here are some ways you can utilize what you've learned in this book on a daily basis in both your personal and professional life. 1. Reflect and practice what you've learned. Even something as small as preparing dinner is an opportunity for learning. If your meat is tough and unpalatable, you've learned you'll want to try a different cooking method and change up your seasonings the next time you prepare a meal. You'll think about the cut of meat you've purchased and look at recipes and cookbooks for information of the best methods and flavor profiles for the best way to prepare that type of meat. You'll learn you don't cook a pot roast the same way as a filet mignon and be able to extrapolate that knowledge with similar cuts of meat from different animals. 2. Use your time wisely. You may recall early in this book that I mentioned falling into a YouTube black hole, only to snap out of it 2 hours later wondering how you happened to be watching the video playing in front of you. That happens to all of us. Whether we waste time scrolling through Facebook or surfing the internet, we could all use our time more wisely. This doesn't mean we don't all deserve a break. Just be cautious of how much time you spend doing mindless activities and how much you spend investing in hobbies and pursuing activities you enjoy and further your conclusion. 2 people walk into a hospital emergency room at the same time. One person states that he has the worst headache of his life. He's been vomiting nonstop all morning. He has blurry and feels dizzy. The other person states he fell off a ladder a few days ago, and he's had a backache since. He doesn't think anything is broken, but he isn't feeling any better, and he's in a lot of pain. He's having difficulty walking, and his pain hasn't improved from the date of his original injury. Who do the doctors treat first? On the surface, both lists of symptoms might seem fairly benign, but both of them can be serious. Does the first patient have a migraine? Or is he having a brain aneurysm? What about patient 2? His back pain is fairly nonspecific. Did he pinch a nerve or tear muscles or tendons? It's also possible he's slipped a disc or, despite his assessment, has a broken vertebra in his back. It's also possible he could be seeking narcotic pain relievers and there's no injury at all. These are all things the triage nurse will take into account as when he or she decides the order patients get seen by a doctor. These are all critical thinking skills that are part of her job. Whether or not you are a triage nurse or even work in a medical field, you probably do some form of triage too. You make decisions about what to handle at work and at home based on the priority and exigency of the circumstances. If you have a project due tomorrow, that will take precedence over the one due next month. A crying infant will be soothed before helping your grade schooler with her homework. You make these decisions based on your ability to think critically, and this book has shown you how to develop and enhance those skills so you are empowered to achieve more and be successful. Now, this has been The Art of Thinking Critically. Ask great questions, spot illogical reasoning, and make sharp arguments. The Critical Thinker, Book 5, written by Albert Rutherford, narrated by Russell Newton. Copyright 2020 by Albert Rutherford. Production copyright by Albert Rutherford.
More information regarding today's book and the author can be found at audible.com or amazon.com. Show notes and further information can be found at RussellEricNewton.com. With an eclectic collection of insights, knowledge, and trivia from some of the newest audiobooks on the market, this has been the Voice Over Work podcast, brought to you by Newton Media Group, a family of creative services.